You're listening to the Seabreeze Church Podcast.
Morning, everyone. Good to see you today. About 2 weeks ago, I think it was, another national survey was published that confirms something that's been going on for some time in our nation. And it actually confirms something we already know intuitively about the state of the Christian faith in America, and that is that it is in decline. Here in California, we are one of the states that have been leading in this decline for some time. I believe that the effects of this decline that's been going on for some time now in our nation is showing up in an increase in human pain and suffering in our nation. I read a report recently that identified a very interesting correlation between the percentage of drop in church attendance in the U.S. and the exact same percentage of rise in the addiction rates. It was interesting, it was just an exact track. They tracked each other perfectly over time. Now, there's no way to prove a link between these two, but the correlation data tells a pretty, I think, convincing story. But for all the bad news, I think this is a great time to be a follower of Jesus. And I think this is a great place to live as a follower of Jesus Christ. And that's because the Christian faith has always operated better from a position of weakness. So we're getting down to our fighting weight. We're getting down to the sides in which the church is really at its best. And the book of 2 Corinthians explains why this is. Power and Weakness is the name of this message series that we started last week, and it is the theme of this book, and this is the book that we are working our way through in the coming weeks. This New Testament book was written by the Apostle Paul, who had started a church in the city of Corinth. That's where the name 1 and 2 Corinthians comes from. He'd started this church in 50 AD. Now, at the time that he started this church, there was no city. Corinth was unique in the Roman Empire. There was no city in the Roman Empire that was more advanced than Corinth. It had been destroyed and recently rebuilt, and there were all kinds of opportunities, lots of new people flooding in, citizens and former slaves alike were flocking to this city to make a new future for themselves. And in a sense, scholars report that this was probably the most advanced and most progressive city of the entire Roman Empire. And in that way, it was pretty similar to California. One scholar even refers to 1 and 2 Corinthians as 1 and 2 Californians. And I think that's a pretty interesting correlation. And it was in this place, in Corinth, that this small struggling church was started by the Apostle Paul. The odds of its survival had to be low. But not only did this church survive, it became part of the Christian movement that over time swept the entire Roman Empire and beyond. No one, I think, at the time that this church was started in this particular place could have imagined this outcome. So the question that people often ask is it possible that something like that could happen again? And I would say, yeah, I think it is possible. I don't know if it will, but I think it's very possible. And if it does happen, the way it's going to happen is the same way it's always happened for followers of Jesus Christ in churches like Corinth. It's through the power of personal influence, life by life, one person at a time. Now, we tend to think of power from a top-down perspective. You know, this is an organizational chart that if you're in business or pretty much any organization, you're aware of this. And it's obvious that power comes from the top. I mean, if you're at the top of a company or the top of a country, you have the power to influence that country or that company. But God takes the opposite approach. God takes the bottom-up approach to power. And that's because he is interested in changing people, changing their hearts, not just their behavior. And that kind of change, that kind of power is life to life. It's influenced by one another. It starts at the bottom. It's a grassroots kind of thing. It's not, you can't command someone to change. You can't exert power over the human heart. And so God looks at power the opposite way that we do. People are influenced most deeply by those who love them. That's why the ideas that can travel from people to people, they're the ones that change lives. People are changed not speech by speech, but relationship by relationship. Now, we believe that Jesus Christ has the power to transform the human heart. Most of us have experienced the beginnings of that transformation. So what is the plan of God to get this amazing help, this power, the word out in this world? Well, the plan is to start churches like in Corinth 2,000 years ago and like this one here. Not primarily so that someone like me can stand up and speak and change the world, but so that someone like you can love the people that God has put in your path and invite them to join you in a community that transforms them. That's the plan of God. It's a bottom-up approach. Now, last week, we started this series by looking at the conditions that God often uses to connect us to his power. Today, we're going to continue by considering how it is that God's power not just can connect to us directly, but how it can flow through us and influence the lives of the people that God has placed around us. That is the power of influence. Our guide is going to be the very end of chapter 1. We started in chapter 1 last week. We're going to finish up chapter 1 and cover chapter 2. And in these, the end of chapter 1 and all of chapter 2, Paul really identifies four ways that he has loved them. And these four are key ways that we gain influence for good in the life of someone else. So we're going to look at these four powers of influence. So if you want to change the world, don't climb the ladders of power. Descend into the trenches of doing the hard work of loving the people that God has placed around you. So let's look at influence power number one. Work with them for their joy. Work with them for their joy. We are influenced by the people we open our hearts to. But in this broken world, we are often hurt by the people that we open our hearts to. So our constant question, you may not hear this in your mind, but it's a constant question, it is this: are you for me or are you against me? We're constantly asking this question. Or the more common terms that are often used now is, are you safe or are you unsafe? Recently, my wife and I were talking, and I could tell the conversation wasn't getting anywhere, and finally she asked me if I was upset with her. And at that moment, I realized, oh, I'm upset about something else. I'm not upset with her, but the fact that I'm upset about something else is leaking into my conversation with her, and it's sounding like I'm upset with her. So it was showing up in our conversation, so I cleared that up and apologized for not communicating with interest and compassion because my mind was upset with something else. But what happened in that conversation is my words had absolutely no influence on her heart until she was able to determine whether I was for her or against her. Now, that may seem like a strange question for the two of us because we've been married for 39 years. There is no woman on this planet, there's no person on this planet that I'm more for than her. How dare she ask if I'm for her? Well, if you're married, you know how this works. You said that you are for that person when you got married, but as I said, this is a constant question. The are you for me question is not something that's settled in an act like marriage or any other act in a friendship. It's not locked in on a contractual basis. It's a dynamic, fluid question. Are you for me now, or are you against me now? It's a constant question. So with all of us asking this question constantly, how can we have an influence on others for good? This is what Paul says that gives us insight into this in 2 Corinthians 1, 23 through 24. He says, I call God as my witness that it was in order to spare you that I did not return to Corinth, not that we lord it over your faith, but we work with you for your joy, because it is by faith you stand firm. Those last three phrases are very key to understand what he's talking about. We'll look at each of them. So here's the context. In the first letter, 1 Corinthians, to this church, Paul had addressed some of the problems, some of the sin that was going on in the church. And at the end of the letter, he told them that he was planning to come and visit them, really to kind of check up on them. But now he's saying that he decided not to visit them. Why? He says, in order to spare you. Spare them from what? Paul is deciding to not visit because he wants to spare them from the power that freedom gives them to change at a heart level. And he knows if he shows up, it's going to be too much pressure. And they're not really going to change. You see, to change, we all do need hard conversations like Paul had in the first letter of Corinthians. We need to be able to say hard things to each other, and we need to be able to hear hard things. The reason is that we are all sinners, and we don't always see our sin. So we need the help of these difficult conversations. But hard conversations are risky. That's why they're so rare. It sounds like the person who is addressing something in our life is talking against us, which triggers our defenses, and we just kind of naturally close up. And that's why in between the hard conversations, there needs to be a lot of space and a lot of freedom for them to consider what has been said. And that's what Paul's concern is. You guys need some space now. So I'm not going to come visit. Why do people need space? Paul says it's because it's by faith that you stand firm. This is true of all of us. What people do or don't do is determined by what they believe in. Now, we all live by faith. This isn't just for people who consider themselves to be religious. Everybody lives by some faith. We all have faith. You know, if you're, say, a materialist, that's the dominant religion in our country right now. It's not an organized religion, but it is an organized thought system, and it's what most people are living. So if you're a materialist who is living for only what you can see, that's what it means to be a materialist. You only believe that the material, you know, what's on the periodic table of elements is all that's real. That's all you're living for. That is your faith. You are trusting. You are believing that there is nothing after this life, and that there is nothing more to this life than what you can see. That is a big leap of faith. There's a lot of logical problems with that, but that's what most people are living right now, in faith. And that is how, if you're a materialist, that's how you're building your life, one decision at a time. You are standing on that faith system, that faith thought. Now, we all do this faith thing. We all do faith. You know, and because we can't know the future, we don't know for sure what's going to happen, but we make decisions in the present because we believe that what we are doing now is going to make a better future. We don't know, but in faith, we're making this decision based on what we believe. That's faith, and we all have faith. The key question is not whether you're a person of faith or not. The key question is, what is your faith? What do you have faith in? Now, for followers of Jesus Christ, our faith is in the God of the Bible. We stand, we build our lives on what he says. Now, change occurs at a faith level, not a behavior level. We can conform for a while on a behavior level, but then we'll go back to what we really believe. If you want to change someone, their faith is what has to be addressed, what they really believe. So for Christians, change occurs when we take a part of the Bible and trust it enough to do it. Not when someone makes us feel bad enough to do something, but when we actually decide, not only do that we agree this is true, but this is real and we're going to act on it. That's how change occurs. Now our tendency, and Paul addresses this next, our tendency is to lord it over someone's faith. What does that mean? I think you probably have a sense of what that means because that's what we do. You know, we maybe have a hard conversation and they just don't seem to be taking it to heart. Maybe they didn't hear it. Maybe I wasn't clear enough. So we say it again, and maybe with a little more emotion. We kind of ramp up the pressure. We kind of try to be the boss of their faith. That never works. In fact, it almost always backfires. And that's because you cannot force the faith of anyone else. That's why Paul said, not that we lord it over your faith. We can't pressure people to make any changes at the faith level. Each person has to decide on their own what they're going to trust. And so Paul was concerned that if he showed up, it would bring too much pressure on them. They might conform, put on the show, look good while he was there, but as soon as he left, they'd go back to what they really believed, and he had no interest in playing that game. And he decided, actually, that his visit would bring too much pressure and not give them enough space and enough freedom to really wrestle with what he had said and decide for themselves whether they believed it and whether they were going to do something about it. So that's why he canceled the trip. Now, this is a very important concept to grasp. We cannot change anyone. I think many of you know that, but boy, we try. We cannot change anyone. Now that, let's be honest, that is unwelcome news. Especially if you're a parent. And especially if you're married. You can't change anyone. So how can we influence someone? We can't put pressure on them. We can't force them. But we can have an influence on them. God's power can move through us to work change in them. How? Well, Paul says, by working with them for their joy. Everyone is in pursuit of joy. Everyone woke up today with a preference to feel better, not worse. Everyone is making decisions today so that this day might be better and not worse. Everyone would rather be happy than sad. If they're sad, they're trying to be happy. If they're happy, they're trying to augment that happiness. Everyone is in pursuit of joy. So find out what particular joy they're pursuing and figure out if you can help them. Now, if it's a sin, you can't help them with that. But everyone has some kind of source of joy that you can help them with. Figure out what that is and get on their team. When our two children were in the teen years, the hard conversations increased. I mean, that's just common. As they're trying to figure out, that's really what adolescence is about, is what do I actually believe? I know what mom and dad believes. What do I believe? And so as people are trying to figure that out, they tend to want to do some stuff that is going to cause long-term damage. So we just had to say no more than we had probably since they were two. And that's a tough environment when it comes to relationship when you're saying no all the time. So that doesn't mean you have to stop saying no. That's your responsibility as a parent. If your child's about to jump off a cliff, you have to say no. But what we did is we worked hard for years to find ways to say yes. We had to say no. Didn't have to say yes. But we wanted to say yes. We spent money and figured out all kinds of things that would bring joy and delight because we knew it was a strain on the relationship to say no so much. We wanted them to know that we were with them, not against them. Now, they weren't always convinced, but we worked hard at that. You know, I really wish that I could put my faith in others. I really wish, if you're a parent, don't you wish you could just put your faith in your child? If you're married, don't you wish you could just put your faith in your spouse? But you can't. Because faith is like standing. As he says, we stand on faith. I can't stand for you, and you can't stand. I have to stand on my own 2 feet. We all do. But I can love you, and God can use that to change you. That's influence power number one, work with them for their joy. Influence power number two, feel with them, not against them. So if you're wondering whether you're for somebody or against somebody, doesn't matter what you say, your emotions will tell you the truth. It's one of the great gifts of emotions. You don't want to live for them, but they're a great indicator of what's really going on in the heart. Here's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 2, verse 4. For I wrote you out of great distress and anguish of heart and with many tears, not to grieve you, but to let you know the depth of my love for you. It would have been very easy for this church in Corinth to get the idea from Paul's first letter to them that he was against them. I mean, if you read through 1 Corinthians, he confronts them a lot of stuff. But in this second letter, Paul sets the record straight. He goes back to when he's writing this first letter and tells them that as he was writing this, he was crying. He wasn't stomping around and angry, and I can't believe those people in Corinth and this and that. He was writing with tears. There is an emotional indicator that lets you know whether you're working with someone for their joy or you're trying to lord it over them for your joy. And here's the indicator. Are you more angry at them or sad for them? Anger or sadness? If someone is not changing and you are more angry than sad, that's because you're more focused on how their lack of change is affecting your life than on how it's affecting their life. Let me say it again. This is very important. If someone is not changing and you are more angry than sad at them, that's because you're more focused on how their lack of change is affecting you than how it's affecting them. And when you get angry, you have just cut off all influence. You have actually become the last person that God will use to help them change. And that's because anger only raises the fences. It does that with all of us. If you get angry with me, I'm not open to input from you. Same reverse. And what happens when we get angry is now our anger becomes the issue, not whatever the issue was that made us angry. There was one problem, now you got angry, now there's two problems. And the anger is the bigger problem because it's got all the emotional weight to it. Now, I'm not saying that if you walk up to someone and start crying, they're going to instantly change. No, that's not a tactic. Tears are not magic agents of change. The point is that until you care enough to grieve over how their sin is hurting them and their future more than it's how it's hurting you and your future, you will have no real influence in their lives. So how do you get to sadness? This is something I've struggled with. It's very easy to get angry. I find it hard to be sad. Honestly sad. I could spend a whole lot of time on this. We don't have time, so let me just give you two words, and you can chew on these and work on these. Prayer and compassion. This is how you get to sadness. I just ask God to show me this person as he sees them. You know, Jesus, when he was approaching Jerusalem, he got to a hill overlooking the city of Jerusalem, and he just broke down and started crying. No one else did. It's because Jesus saw that they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And he cried. So I've asked God many times, God, I'm so furious about this person or this situation, that what they did. Show me what you see. What do you see in this person? What is it that breaks your heart for this person? Help me to see that. So I just pray, I just ask God. And then compassion. The word compassion means literally to feel with. Co is a prefix that means with. Passion is passion, it's feeling. So the idea of compassion is we try to imagine what they must be experiencing. You know what they're causing us to experience, but what's going on with them? What's happening? Feel with them. So that's influence power number two. Feel with them, not against them. Influence power number three. Forgive them for their wrong. Forgive them for their wrong. The older you are, the more likely it is that you're bitter. The reason is because there's more wrong that's been done to you. I mean, in a broken world, we just can't put in miles here without being hurt, without being wronged. And if we don't forgive, then that turns into sourness of heart, which is bitterness. And we just have this, well, cranky old tendency. That's just a part of the challenge of age. There's many challenges of age. Bitterness, I think, is one of the big ones. And over time, what can happen to us and what will happen naturally is bitterness replaces influence. You have to pick one. Are you going to have influence on people's lives, or are you going to be bitter at people? They cancel each other out. So here's the next thing Paul says in chapter 2 of 2 Corinthians, verses 10 through 11. If you forgive anyone, I also forgive him. And what I have forgiven, if there was anything to forgive, I have forgiven in the sight of Christ for your sake, in order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes. It's fascinating. So the theme of this verse is, guess what? Forgiveness. I mean, he says it, forgive, forgive, forgiven, forgiven five times. It's like, don't miss this. Sometimes it's hard to figure out the theme. What's the theme? This is obvious. Why should we forgive? Paul says, in order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes. What is Paul talking about? Well, again, you need a little context. In the book of 1 Corinthians, Paul addressed a man in the church who had sinned publicly and was affecting the entire church. And so he had addressed this sin. Now, the good thing is this man had repented of this sin, and therefore he had been forgiven by God. The problem was God had forgiven this man, they hadn't. And that's what Paul is addressing. Paul says, if they don't hurry up and forgive this guy, they are going to be playing into one of the enemy's common schemes. Now, I don't have a copy of the enemy's playbook, but from my experience and my study of Scripture, it's nothing like an NFL playbook. I mean, I think it's probably got 7 to 10 plays on it. But they are so effective, they don't need to be inventive. And this is one of the plays, is to let bitterness take over a person's life. Paul says, if we don't forgive, we're playing into the enemy's scheme. What's the scheme? Well, I think the main scheme of all of the plans that the enemy has is to keep people from ever thinking about Jesus Christ, to take their focus off of Jesus. Because everything we do is done, as Paul says here, for example, in the sight of Christ. If you read through the book of 2 Corinthians, you see this show up again and again before God, in the sight of Christ, in the presence of God. It's a theme. And Jesus isn't just looking at us when we forgive or don't forgive. Everything we do is done before his watchful eye. Why? The point that's being made in this theme is that we will all stand before the one who's been watching us. Everything we do is in front of him. We'll stand before him. And on that day, we will stand on our faith. In other words, what we really believe, not what we say we believe. The evidence will be the lives that we build. We can't say, I believe in that, and here's the life I've built over here. No, the life will just point to the foundation, what we actually believe. That will be what happens. Now, Satan knows about this eventuality better than we do. He knows this better than any of us. He is dreading that day, because that's the day when he will be judged. And so his scheme is to keep our minds as far as possible from that truth. He doesn't want us to ever figure out that in the end, we will all stand before the one who's been watching our every move. And if we at some point become aware of this truth, like I guess most people in this room probably know of this, Then his goal is to keep us distracted from the reality of it, hour by hour, day by day, year by year. And one of the ways, there's a lot of ways he does this, is by getting us so upset with someone that we can't see God anymore, and we can't see the kind of life that we're building. You know, in battle, a smokescreen is used to hide stuff. And in the battle for our soul, I think conflicts, relational conflicts, are like a smokescreen that's used to distract us from what really is important. Whenever two people argue or fight or get mad at each other or have a conflict or hurt each other, they generate all kinds of emotional smoke. When you're upset with somebody, it's almost hard to function. It's consuming. That's all you can see. God? God who? I'm mad at this person. So if Satan can make things personal between two people, when the real problem, in fact, is between them and God, then that is his mission accomplished. This is why I think Satan is constantly inciting us to fight and argue and hold on to our bitternesses. Forgive, Paul says, in order that Satan might not outwit us, and see too late that all of this anger is just smoke. It's a distraction. So get out the fan of forgiveness, Paul says, and blow the smoke of bitterness away. Clear the landscape so you can see God, what he is doing, and the kind of life you're building. And if we get upset with someone else, then the same thing is happening to them. They're all focused on how mad they are with us. They're not thinking about God. We want to influence people towards God. We don't want to distract them from God. And conflict, I think, is one of the biggest distractions in this world. And I think it's, I don't know if it's number one, maybe number two or three of the enemy's playbook. It's throughout the history of the world. Get everyone fighting, looking at each other, and never looking up to think about the day when they will stand before the one who's been watching. Influence power number four, the last one. Join the triumphal procession. So far, the influences that we've been looking at are personal in nature. The verses that we've been looking at are marked by the word I. You can go back and look for yourself on this. Now Paul turns our attention to the influence marked by the word us. Together. He's talking about the impact that we can have collectively as followers of Jesus working together as the body of Christ here on earth, the church. And he has an amazing image that he presents of what the church looks like now and the effect the church has in this world. 2 Corinthians 2:4 through 16, he says, "But thanks be to God who always leads us in triumphal procession in Christ, and through us spreads everywhere the fragrance of the knowledge of him. For we are to God the aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and those who are perishing. To the one we are the smell of death, to the other the fragrance of life, and who is equal to such a task?" Paul is describing a well-known scene in ancient Rome, the scene of the conquering legions returning from battle to the cheers of the celebrating crowds. But those parades had a very different key element than the parades that we're familiar with. Leading in these parades would be the slaves who had been captured from the land that they had just conquered. And so the procession would be led by these slaves in chains, the soldiers, generals behind. And at the end of this parade, all of the slaves who had been force marched ahead of them into the city would be put to death so that the entire city could see the power of Rome. That's the kind of triumphal procession that Paul is referring to. Now, one of the questions that people have had over the years is, where does Paul see the church in this procession? Are we the soldiers and the generals, or are we the slaves? Most scholars, and I agree with them, believe that Paul is identifying the followers of Christ with the slaves who would lead, as it says here, in this procession, not the generals and the conquering soldiers. So then why is this called a triumphal procession from a Christian perspective, one that we thank God for? It's because the entire parade is in fact a death march. Everybody in this parade, this life parade, is marching towards their death. We don't want to think about it, but not just the slaves are going to die at the end of this parade, we're all going to die at the end of this parade. And those who have decided to follow Jesus have done so because, like those slaves, they were fully aware of their impending death. And so the followers of Jesus Christ, we are not living for this life. We live in this life and have responsibilities in this life, but we are living this life in view of the next life. And as such, we are living as slaves of Christ, which is the term that Paul most often used to describe what it really means to be a Christian, a slave of Christ. Now, what's interesting about this parade is not just being a part of the parade, but the effect that this procession in time of the church, slaves of Christ, marching in front of the victorious, whoever is in victory at that point in the culture, the effect that it has on the crowd is what Paul turns his attention to. Paul says it divides the watching crowd into two groups. Those who are only interested in this life is group one, and those who are at least curious about eternity, that's group two. To the YOLO group, the you only live once group, we smell like death. Why? Well, because we're the obvious losers in life. I mean, we're giving our life for something you can't see. What a waste if there is no something you can't see. To those who are interested in the possibility of a God and concerned about life after death, we give off a very different aroma. We give off the aroma of life. So the people who are the materialists or only living for this world, we stink the place up. They react negatively to us. To the others who are curious, they at least tilt their head and are leaning in. Not because we're so moral, but because it's obvious we're living for something more than this life. Now, I want you to notice that as Christians, we are to give off not just the knowledge of Christ, but the fragrance of the knowledge of Christ. That's very interesting. I think the logic of the Christian faith is compelling. I am happy to debate the rationality of the Christian faith with anyone. But you know, people don't make a decision for Jesus based on the knowledge. It helps, but it's the fragrance of the knowledge. And the reason is because this is a big decision. For people to join the slave procession, to live this life for the next life, That's a big life-changing decision. And people want more than just black and white words as evidence. They want a sense that this is real. That's the smell test. One time I was making a turkey sandwich, and I noticed that the meat smelled bad. I don't know if you've ever done that. So I picked out the package, looked on the date, and the date said the meat was good. So what did I do? I didn't eat that turkey sandwich. Why not? The black and white words said that that turkey should be fine. I trust my nose more than the black and white words. And it's the same with people. And it's the same with Jesus. People will smell to see if this is real before they will ingest it. So if you are living the slave of Christ kind of life, your life is a powerful aroma. But this is real. I mean, why else would someone do this? I guess delusion, but it's hard to get a bunch of people to be that delusional. It's a powerful aroma. You know, the church, in this image of Paul, looks like the losing part of the parade, but in fact, it's the winning part of the parade. And so as followers of Jesus Christ, we just have to get used to weakness. We have to get used to slave of Christ status and looking like losers. Because we're living for more than this life. So I invite you to join us as we work with people for their joy. We feel with them rather than against them. And we forgive others. We blow away the smoke of bitterness. We are in the front of this great triumphal parade, and people are watching, and people are deciding. Let's pray. Father, as Paul said at the end of that verse, and who is equal to such a task as this? We certainly aren't. In our own power, we can't influence anyone. But it's as we chain ourselves to you, become your slaves, that we find life in this life and life in the life to come. And so I pray that you'd help us to give off the aroma of a life that is truly built, not just for this world only, but in light of what you've said. Father, I pray for our city in this state, very much like the Corinthian city. There is tremendous pain below the surface of the affluence. God, I pray that we as a church would give off the aroma that draws people to you. And for those who are committed to living only for this life, that it would just confirm that for them. And we would stink the place up. We are not equal to this task, and we ask for help to be an influence in those around us. We pray this now in your name, Jesus. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the Seabreeze Church podcast. For more information about our church, you can visit our website, seabreezechurch.com. Thanks again for listening in, and we hope you'll join us next week for the Seabreeze Church podcast.